Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sarah Gone Rogue. And I've gone rogue today as I'm coming to you from the mother city, from Cape Town. And it is a lovely, sunny, mild day so far. So we'll see how that goes, and I may report back on what I'm doing in due course. Well, as somebody said, nobody wants to sing Kumbaya with Cyril Ramaphosa anymore. There's been a walkout of the National Dialogue by now 7 civil society organizations, foundations. And it's a sort of list of the foundations that would be, let's say, largely, not entirely, but largely ANC aligned, which is not so much the Steve Biko Foundation, but the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, Chief Albert Luthuli Foundation, Desmond and Leah Tutu's Foundation, F.W. de Klerk, Oliver and Adelaide Tambo Foundation, and the Strategic Dialogue Group. Now, it appears that the idea has been long in the making, and was actually Mbeki's idea to convene a national dialogue, and it was him that got on board. But it seems to have been taken as a pet, hopefully, maybe political career-saving moment by Ramaphosa. And last week, the discussions around the first meeting, which is due to be held on Friday to set the agenda for further meetings, went off the rails, and they really argued that there were a number of problems, and firstly that there had not been enough time for preparation. They needed it to be run and to be in the hands of and to be seen by and to be in the hands of credible, principled and anchored entities, which are anchored in public trust. And it needs accordingly to be civil society led. And it is clearly had become Cyril Ramaphosa's pet project. But, you know, one really, you know, the fact that he's dead set about doing it and about starting on Friday. And it looks like the size of the project is just such that it went into things very, very quickly. And the ANC is just not prepared for it. So we'll see how it pans out and whether it has any meaning once it's gone on Friday, unless it's cancelled before that.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Right, welcome back to the Sarah Gone Rogue show. And an incident, an issue that has been bubbling under and has finally sort of really come to the fore, but is very perturbing, is that the Defence Minister, Angie Motshekga, has been criticised by the DA for the missing 813 million rand intended for South African National Defence Force troops. And this particularly covers the troops who were stationed in the awful, awful set of circumstances that surrounded the civil war, or rather the war that's happening on the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And these were deployment allowances. So they were meant to be paid to those troops who are deployed. And they've tried to get the Parliamentary Committee for Defence to call the minister to account, but she has failed to appear. And apparently this is not the first time she has failed to appear on numerous occasions. And we have the extraordinary scenario where the chairperson, Juan Maluzi Gigaba, and we'll come to him a bit in a while and see, now refuses to call her to come to the committee. And the objection is requiring her to come is met with him saying that simply, she's required to submit a report on this, and you know, things will happen in due course. And basically, blame has been thrown back at the DA. Now, just a reminder, because one tends to forget very quickly what essentially disgraced Malusi Kigaba was. He'd been found by the public protector to have violated the constitution and the executive ethics code of parliament. The matter in this case involved a contract with Fireblade Aviation, a matter of Fireblade Aviation versus the Minister of Home Affairs, and he was in Home Affairs at the time. And basically he found that the Northern Gauteng High Court found that Kigaba had lied under oath and committed a breach of the constitution so serious it could be characterized as a violation of the constitution. The DA followed on with laying charges of perjury against Mr. Kigaba for that. I'm not quite sure where that ended. He's also been accused in that period of tenure, and we're not even looking at the period in which he was responsible for much of the disaster that went on at SAA during the 2000, I guess 2000, probably he went to Parliament about 2011 to 2018. In that period, he held these two positions. But while as Home Affairs Minister, he instituted visa legislations that were so onerous and literally threatened, if not reduced, the possibility of investment and jobs being created. These were implemented and damaged large sectors of our economy. So he's very much part of that either do nothing approach of the ANC government or do what hurts our society the most. And I'd forgotten this, but during his tenure as finance minister, so that was probably the beginning, I actually can't remember the order, there were tax increases included the increase to the current 15% VAT. And as we know, SOEs under him continued to receive massive bailouts. So the bailouts occurred before, during, and after his tenure, but he was very much part of that structure that allowed it to happen. And he's however said that the DA has said in response to him that basically the SANDF is unable to do basic accounting because office-based staff are alleged to have received the full allowances, which were meant for frontline soldiers, and leave pay was calculated incorrectly, and there's no clarity on where the rest of the money went. Now, I know it's a huge amount of money, but it strikes me that with a competent accounting person in the system, that should not have been difficult to account for, unless it's difficult to account for because it was misdirected and directed in directions it shouldn't have gone. As the DA has said, the SANDF continues to bungle its finances on a grand scale. And instead of addressing the mess, Kigaba has shielded the minister and the SANDF from scrutiny. Then they apparently had initially, the committee had agreed to write to the minister to get answers to these very vexing questions, and then Kigaba suddenly blocked the committee from acting. And then days later, Minister Moshoeshoe issued a press statement bemoaning the DA's oversight. So how is that? You know, they're not happy about the very processes that are meant to be keep them accountable to us and to the and to also give what is due to people, to soldiers who had to largely endure a terrifying situation when a rebel group took over the area in which they were based, and they were essentially, I don't know, prisoners of war. So we seem to have a very much an ANC-run committee that is protecting yet another minister who has not acquitted herself at all well as the Minister of Defence and Veteran Affairs, and is was simply preceded by a whole range of ministers, including at least another two female ministers who did nothing and or did worse than nothing. And we have a hollowed out defence force as a result. So where our accountability is going to come from, I honestly don't know. And this is my concern about, this is the business of running the country, and yet at the same time, we are in a situation where the president is clinging desperately to a national dialogue that by all accounts would take a couple of years to work its way through. And anyway, you're not voted into power to listen to what people say without there being consequences or responsibility for anything that is said and decided in such a forum. So all in all, it really looks like the ANC is battening down the hatches while it implodes. The sense is that it is so enmeshed in trying to keep itself alive that absolutely nothing else and no one else matters.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Good morning. And this morning I would like to welcome a special guest, Mr. Ray Hartley, because we're going to discuss a conference that was held by Southern African Liberation Movements a short while ago. Ray is an independent commentator. He was formerly research director of the Brenthurst Foundation and previously edited the Sunday Times, The Times, Rand Daily Mail, and Business Live. And he's the author of a number of books, which I think is very brave, because I would imagine trying to do books and run a working life is nigh impossible. But Ray, welcome to Chai FM.
Great to be here.
Ray, this conference that took place of Southern African Liberation Movements, first question is, are they still liberation movements?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think that one of the things about the liberation movements is they try to live in the past, which is try to pretend that they're still at the front lines of some kind of battle between good and evil, between oppressors and oppressed. That actually is long over because they've been ruling in the countries, you know, where these battles took place for many, many decades now. And in fact, today's ills in those societies are certainly, they take the lion's share of responsibility for those. But it's useful for them to have this pretense that they're still engaged in the old, good and evil battle, a sort of populist, juxtaposition of the, you're either on with us or you're against us, because they feel increasingly under threat in their societies, I think, from people who are no longer satisfied with their rule.
Could one partly attribute it to almost the way one hears of people coming out of a period of war? Generally, in any context, that their heyday was pretty much the 60s, the intensity, the adrenaline rush, the intellectual debates that were mostly covered systems that favored Marxism. Could that be part and parcel of this, or is it really just a case of things are not going well? They're not, the transition to being governments has not been as successful as it should have been, and so there's an inclination to hark back to the past.
Yeah, I think the heyday was definitely during the struggle years. I mean, the liberation movements were very effective, in fact, at bringing about fundamental change in the societies. And that needs to be acknowledged. You know, I mean, these were not fantastic examples of how countries should be governed, you know, from some kind of European metropole, or in South Africa's case, by a tiny elite in the society. So they were very good at that, but that did not translate into governance. There's no kind of, and in fact, very unprepared for governance in many cases. And in many cases, taking on, just sort of taking over the state that they inherited and that they'd fought against and repopulating it with themselves. And in fact, continuing pretty much as it was, but just they're just a different elite that's now benefiting, and that is the liberation movement elite in the society. So the absence and the unreadiness to govern, I mean, even in South Africa's case, you know, the ANC was not ready at all to take power in South Africa. It eventually lent very heavily on the trade union movements because Kassatu had produced through some intellectuals a publication called Merge, which sort of at least tried to conceptualize how governance should take place in a post-apartheid society. And so they borrowed very heavily from that. And it wasn't really much of a recipe really for governance, so much as a set of ideological kind of prescriptions. And so you had very poor governance, I think, over the last, you know, well, say, you know, since 1980 in Zimbabwe, for example, because eventually you run out of the resources that you're preying on in the society. And then you find yourself exposed and having to take those resources from someone else. And so you have nationalization, let's get the money out of business into the hands of the governing elite and so on. And then the economy slide pretty fast.
What was the purpose of the conference, given the fact that essentially one's looking at harking back to the past or relying on to some extent? Was it just to sort of bolster the participants' sense of purpose, or did it have a very distinct objective?
Yeah, I think the objective is to, you know, I think it's actually not just a nostalgia party, because if you look at an organization like the SA, you know, the SADC, you know, the AU looks to the sub-regional organization for direction, and the UN looks to the AU for direction. So when there's an election held in Southern Africa, the response of the regional body becomes all important. And there was a big wobble when, you know, Zambia had the temerity to suggest, because Zambia was, a Zambian was running the election observation mission in Zimbabwe, had the temerity to suggest that the election was not great. And there was panic. So they actually, and there's an election coming up in Tanzania later this year, the elections in Angola in the near future. And basically, they need to shore this up, because until now, it's been a kind of, you know, like a mafia operation. You know, we'll take care of you. Don't worry. There won't be any trouble. You know, it's quite a powerful mechanism, actually, because if you control the sub-regional body, you actually set the template for how the world responds to the region. And right now, I think there's a lot of panic about elections, and elections are going to get rough, and they're going to get more rigged, because there are these uprisings of people against these liberation movements. I mean, we saw what happened in Mozambique. And the Mozambican election was very quickly endorsed. It was a classic example of this. You know, Cyril Ramaphosa didn't even wait for the court in Mozambique, which there's a process where the court has to certify the result. The court didn't even get around to that yet, and already South Africa said congratulations to the new president, etc. There's a, you know, so I think that that shouldn't be underestimated, the value of this in the real world. And of course, America and Trump are on a whole different tangent. They're not really going to follow that kind of advice. They're going to do their own thing. And I think that's quite alarming also for these liberation movements, because until now, they've been able to hold all of the developed world in check with this ingenious little piece of chess. your diplomatic chess?
I think my sense is that it harks, it gives, what you're saying gives credence to what one senses as a very much a sort of the developed world or the first world owes us aid and almost recompense for everything we've been through, even though we're not living in that world at all. I mean, you've got, first of all, the issues and exacerbated by Trump concerning trade globally, and you've also got another new generations, the generations that were allied to you, or during and just after the struggle, are ceasing to be voters, but the elections look like they're still, it's very difficult not to hold them because the elections appear to be, if you've got elections, you've got some bona fides that you have a democracy.
Yeah, you have to hold the election, although there are ways of not holding the election, you know, declaring a state of emergency if there's social unrest. You know, there was a lot of social unrest recently in Angola. And some people suggested that it was not the opposition that was behind that at all, but some malign actors that were trying to engineer a situation where there will be a intervention by government and then state of emergency and so on. So, yeah, but I think that, you know, in Tanzania, the situation is pretty dire. You know, the leader of the opposition in Tanzania, Tundu Lissu, a very, very good man, I've met him many times. He's in jail and he's facing treason charges, and the official opposition in Tanzania is barred from participating in the October election. So they're having to go to these more and more extreme measures to deal with this problem of unpopularity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this kind of gathering of, you know, is a place where they all more or less can agree that they'll stick by each other. You know, so South Africa has not said anything about the leader of the opposition in a Southern African, well, East African country, you know, in jail. Mm. Not a word. Mm. And so that silence and that apparent consent in the geopolitics is what they're after. But I don't think it can last. I think it's, you know, there's going to come a point where there'll be such a response to this authoritarianism that it could be pretty dire for those countries.
Is there any chance in the circumstances and where we are now that the bodies that other bodies rely on to provide the background and reports on the situation start putting it in reverse? In other words, the UN has to know what's going on. I mean, if what you just said, if somebody at the UN would know that's what's happening, go down to the AU and put some sort of pressure or at least query the issue, and therefore AU would have to go down to SADC to, you know, no, in other words, it becomes much more of a, we see a problem here. What are we going to do about it?
I think that once societies enter into a state of conflict, that's possible. But as long as they have these pretend democracies, they are allowed to carry on. And the elastic is getting very stretched, but it's still in the sort of UN's broader definition of, you know, they had an election. Okay, it was contested. Okay, there were problems, but all the countries in the region have recognized them. We have to go along with that. I think that's very much how it works still. I think once you get into a situation of absolute crisis and conflict, the UN can do things like appoint special rapporteurs to go and they did so, for example, in Israel, Gaza. Mm-hmm. And that rapporteur was very outspoken and has since been the subject of quite a lot of controversy. And kind of the UN doesn't like that. I don't like to be in that position. So they've got, you know, envoys and things in South Sudan and so on. But for Southern Africa, it's still seen as relatively compared to the rest of Africa, or, you know, I think also there is a sort of an odd dynamic in that the former colonial powers, France, Britain, etc., and Europe in general, don't want to be seen to be dictating to African bodies about what they should or shouldn't be doing. So there's a kind of diplomatic silence there as well, which enables this environment.
I suppose one could almost call it a soft bigotry of low expectations. It's a paternalism, ironically, when I think, as we know from what we need to do to make our economy grow, you need some fairly tough talk. You need to essentially treat African leaders the way you would treat leaders that you don't feel guilty about, the societies you don't feel guilty about. Is there any sense that, given the fact that, as you said, the elastic is stretching very thin and it's becoming, the potential for conflict against the leadership, against the traditional party stroke movements, that there's any real organized or potential for organization of military style or violent conflict to achieve a change in the current status quo?
Yeah, I think that's also very unlikely. I think these are very repressive societies and they control the security environment very tightly. But also that sort of operation usually requires operating out of a friendly neighborhood country that will allow you to do so. And, you know, the matrix of countries just doesn't exist for that. So I don't think that's an option. And I also think the oppositions are not going in that direction. They're going in the opposite direction. If I look at UNITA in Angola, you know, once the Bush War Party of Jonas Savimbi, very much strong in the south and supported by South Africa, and UNITA's graduated into a completely different organization now. It's very urban. It's got young supporters. Its leader, Adalberto Costa Jr., is a very sophisticated urban guy from Luanda. And, you know, they're a different kind of party. They're a political party. They actually want to win power at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely no interest or desire on their part to return to the Bush War, because it's just so difficult to do so. I mean, it's and the problem is that parties like that then find themselves under pressure from youth who are demanding more urgent change. Nothing's happening. What's going on? Why aren't you doing something? We need to fight. We need to, you know, so they actually are, in a sense, stabilizing those societies by holding off that kind of pressure and saying, no, we should win at the ballot box and we should keep fighting. And he did win the previous election in Angola. It was rigged. And I mean, everybody in the diplomatic community there will tell you that story. The fact that they gave him, almost 50% of the vote tells you that they were in pretty dire straits. So the next election, I don't think they'll be able to do that. So I think those days of military guerrilla style opposition are gone.
And obviously, it begs the question about whether South Africa could be the first country within that grouping to see what was the ruling party and now the largest minority party, but to actually be in that situation with the possibility of dropping far enough that the ANC is not in a position to take advantage of those old of that old support, etc.
Yeah, no, I think that South Africa is definitely, because of a number of things that distinguish South Africa from the other liberation countries, most particularly the constitution, the adoption of the constitution, but also critically importantly, during the Mandela presidency, the popularization of the Constitution amongst the people. It's actually deeply embedded in the society. The whole country watched the CODESA negotiations, saw clause by clause the conflict that went on there, saw the outcome, saw how everybody accepted it. And it was entrenched in legislation in 96. And then there was a campaign by government to actually popularize the Constitution. I think it's something that people have forgotten. But, you know, in every place in the country, there was this issuing of the books of the Constitution, and there was a lot of discussion in the public space. And it's pretty deeply embedded. And when Jacob Zuma attempted to take South Africa back to the true liberation movement fold of state capture and do away with all of these irritating things, constitutional breaks on state power, he failed. And he failed because civil society rose up, the media rose up, and we still had credible elections, and the ANC got hammered in the elections, and he had to be removed because they were heading for disaster, electoral disaster. So, you know, that's, South Africa has a number of things which make it exceptional, including the fact that it's the only country in this region where the majority of people are urbanized. And urban dwellers have a different approach. Information is much more available, online information, public debate, etc. There's a whole different dynamic in a society with the majority urban population. You're not able to control those societies and control information in those societies in the way that you can in Mozambique or Tanzania or Angola. So this sort of South African exceptionalism is real. But of course, that's, you know, that's still not something that is guaranteed forever, and people have to quite zealously guard that, I think, and fight for that.
No, I agree. And I think, it, as you say, we have, I think, given our size relative to richer societies, we have had an extremely robust, notwithstanding a whole lot of pressures, but extremely robust civil society. And it makes it very difficult now, not impossible, but difficult to shake off that sort of push for the recognition of ongoing rights, as you say, as the constitutional said. Just a last question. I see that they had as guests, they really hark back to the glory days. They had China, Cuba, Russia there. Again, except for perhaps Cuba, none of them reflect what they were in the heyday.
No.
So was it just was it a middle finger to the West? Or was it just they thought, you know, well, as long as we seem to hang with the guys we used to hang with, you know, it'll bolster our own sense of pride and self.
Yeah, and I think it's also they get a funding out of those countries. You know, interestingly, China, for example, has funded a liberation movement university in Tanzania. And in fact, members of these political parties, including the ANC, go there and spend time there studying liberation ideology. And so China's very invested in undoing any kind of liberal democratic influence, because I think that runs counter, threatens their ability to dominate in this sub-region, which they consider very important for strategic reasons, its position, the Atlantic, et cetera, as does Russia. And of course, the danger is that, the real danger here is that America is kind of put its hands up and said whatever to, you know, they've done away with their corruption legislation preventing American businesses from conducting corrupt transactions in Africa. They've said that they're not going to comment on the validity or otherwise of elections anymore. I'm not sure if that's been moved to an actual legislative or a presidential signing, but that was something that was reported. And so, you know, it's a golden opportunity, really, for these other forces that aren't democratic and that don't want democracy to thrive, to intervene and to make their presence felt. And I think in South Africa, you know, there is a titanic struggle ahead. You know, a coalition of the ANC, EFF and the MK party is entirely possible in the future. And it would achieve a majority. And it may even achieve enough of a majority to affect the constitution. So that's, you know, we remain constantly on this precipice with the possibility of reversal.
Mm-hmm. So the ramifications, notwithstanding the seeming redundancy, are not to be dismissed lightly. Ray, is there anywhere people could sort of see your writing regularly?
Yeah, I'm working with Dr. Greg Mills on the Platform for African Democrats, which is something we did in the past with the World Liberty Congress and the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, and it carries on. And so, you know, and we regularly publish on the Daily Friend and elsewhere.
Ray, thank you very much for joining me, and I hope we'll have a chance to speak again in the near future.
Great talking to you.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Now, there's a very real risk that the town of Newcastle could effectively become a ghost town because there is the threat that ArcelorMittal, which is one of the main producers of heavy industrial pillars, or what they call longs, and which are used really in major infrastructure and building, is set to collapse, is set to go out of business, because it is making losses it can no longer sustain. The CEO, Kobus Verster, says that directly about 3,500 people would be affected, but indirectly it's believed that about 80,000 people downstream would end up closing, with mines, quarries, possibly even kindergartens and B&Bs would be affected, because there wouldn't be that core community to provide a service towards, and it's the social costs are extremely, extremely high in this regard, and it's a very, very sad indictment. Verster does go on to say that the government does understand the social cost, but it's more than the cost of trying to resolve Newcastle's problems. It's a countrywide issue. He says the way to deal with it is to reduce the scrap discount to 10%, the 10% discount on scrap steel, cut Transnet's iron ore tariff to Newcastle from $28 per tonne to $18 per tonne, and lower Eskom's costs. The changes that need to be done are profound and wide-ranging, and I'm not sure, since the end of September is the deadline for closure, that it will be achieved.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
There's a sad but at the same time sort of heartwarming article I saw last week, and that three victims of the 9/11 attacks, the World Trade Center, etc., were identified last week by New York medical officials. Now, you realize that's nearly 24 years after that extraordinarily horrific and sort of world-changing event occurred. They've identified one Ryan Fitzgerald and Barbara Keating, and a third woman has been identified, but information has not yet been released or agreed to be released by the family. Apparently, they have been trying to identify victims for all these decades, and with quite some level of dedication and commitment. The three victims identified were the 1,651st 52nd and 53rd victims, and that the about 1,100 victims of that infamous Al-Qaeda attack remain unidentified. And apparently they've had kudos from the families that they have made the effort to keep looking and keep trying to identify people in that morass of destruction, that they would have extricated the remains of the dead. And I think there's no doubt that attack echoes across decades. And as the current mayor of New York said, that they're taking a step towards comforting the family members that are still aching from the day and from what happened. So I think there's something, I think it goes to a belief I have in that with regard to tragedy or trauma, and this is often used in the context of the effects of colonization or the Holocaust, etc. You cannot undo history and you cannot change the course of history, and history happens. But as we know, that the maxim that history should inform how you go into your future and what you do with your future, but it shouldn't dictate your future. But that essentially means that you really have to rely on your agency to go forward, and your history will have some impact on how you choose to do that and what you choose to do or not do, as the case may be. And I think there's a lot of tendency to look back on history with the purpose of essentially trying to make up for the traumas of that history. And the reality is you can keep trying to do that, but you cannot make it the basis on which you live your life. Anyway, that's somewhat a positive, if very sad, contemplative note. Thank you for joining me, and I will see you back in Joburg next week.